So you can actually find me on Instagram at Josh Johnson Comedy, on YouTube at Josh Johnson Comedy, on Twitter at Josh Johnson, and on Facebook at Josh J Comedy, as well as my podcast. I have a podcast called The Josh Johnson Show, and it is pretty much anywhere you get podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all those places, Pandora. So check it out. I think it was at, was it Red Rock or it was the Colorado one that we,
yes,
that was where we,
there, and then at the show as well,
yeah, and then there was one time you also dropped by when we were on the road, and we were just chill, it was like you and Kabuka.
I tend to do that, Josh.
So. Yeah.
How has it been since not being able to go to work? I guess you guys were used to waking up in the morning, right? Monday to Friday.
Yeah, I mean, it's good working from home in some aspects because I feel like my mind is a little fresher. I don't have a commute. I don't have, like, you know what I mean? Like I'm not, like, rushing late or anything. But
it's fresher being at home.
It's sometimes. I can tell you, in all honesty, though, there's a certain sharpness that you lose from not being surrounded by the other comics. So I think that just for me, right, for when I'm like, oh, I can just wake up and like do a like quick morning workout, whatever, and then I'm at work, is a bit of a relief as opposed to the hour long commute before. But then for the actual work, when we're doing it, there's very little that beats like being surrounded by the other writers and comics and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Which area of New York do you come from to go into Manhattan?
So I live in Brooklyn. And so, yeah, I end up having to, sometimes it's a trial. 'Cause I'm in Brooklyn, and then I will take like the A or the C all the way into the city. But if there's a problem, I got to like switch trains, or I've even had to get just off the train before and just take a cab the rest of the way before. 'Cause it's,
really?
Yeah, it's not a great system. It's not a,
to us from the outside, it looks like a great system. I mean,
yeah, I think this is what it is. Actually, I think what's happening is that when you live with it, and let's say it's 80% reliable.
Yeah.
You're still thinking about like a fifth of the time I'm screwed. Like a fifth of the time I'm going to be late. Like I've left so, yeah, I've left so early before and still been like, I know I look unreliable, but you should know that I left home an hour and a half ago for a trip that should take 45 minutes. You know what I mean? Then from the outside looking in, if you just don't have the system at all, you see it as like, well, you get there most of the time. It doesn't look that bad. You know what I mean? So I think it's just a perspective thing where it's like from the outside, I think sometimes, and it's like that with anything. It's like that with any industry. It's like if you're not surrounded by it and you don't see the problems with it consistently, yes, you're going to be like, oh, it's probably fine. You know, people get where they're going. And it's like, eventually.
Your description of the New York transport system is similar to what people might say about the world of comedy and stand-up.
There's level, yeah, yeah.
And there's proximity to the bullshit, and there's proximity to the great life. But when you're looking at it from the outside, you kind of assume that everything is just one driver away and a jet and then sandwich and then another jet and then a sandwich, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then just the hit rate. You would assume that... Sometimes that 80% hit rate is very generous. Like, I've definitely had jokes where I'm like, this is going to go however it goes. You know what I mean? Like, especially when you're trying it that first time. Because as the more you do comedy, the more you know how to write, and the higher probability that you know the joke will work because it's funny and you've worked it out in your brain how people might receive it and everything. But then you still just don't know. Like, I had a joke. It got on my nerves. I had a joke last week about how my buddy's dad had to cancel his wedding because of the virus, which would normally be sad. But then my buddy told me that it was his dad's seventh wedding. And so I was like, at seven weddings, Corona did you a favor. You know what I mean? Like, clearly we need to slow you down from marrying everyone. Because, like, seven marriages means six divorces. If you've been divorced six times, like, it's you. Like you're the problem. You know what I mean? Like six women who don't know each other can't all be wrong about you, you know? Because they all signed up and they were like, till death do us part, on second thought. You know what I mean? Like, six times. Like, I don't know. You should lose your marriage license after four. Because clearly you're not, it's not going to work with you. You're just not the type.
You do get those professional fall-in lovers.
Yeah. You know,
They love the thrill of the chase. They love the proposal. They love the dating. And then they love the marriage. And then they enjoy the drama. And then they love the divorce. I think those kind of people who get married so many times, they enjoy the thrill of being divorced. They know it's coming. I mean, if someone has been divorced six times, you are the victim here if you are the spouse, right?
At six divorces, you could go to a divorce lawyer and say, give me the usual. Like that's insane. And so then I tell the story of this whole thing, right, to an audience of people. Yes. And just, they give me nothing. And I was like, not only is this definitely funny, I don't know what happened in y'all's lives that you can't relate to this, but not only is this funny, but also I have a good point. Clearly this dude doesn't need to be marrying more people because it's just not working.
You did that on stage.
I did it on stage. And I've done it on stage a couple times, but one time I did it and just nothing. Like, they were just like stone face, as if they like took his side. And I was just like, there's no side to take. I'm just telling you what happened.
You know what it is? I've seen it happen so many times. It sometimes happens to me. When you tell a joke that is sometimes too personal, because remember that a lot of people either come from divorced.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they are divorced themselves.
Yeah.
Right? Or they might have a small chance of being divorced. So it's already a weird, it's like talking about cancer in front of white people. They either know someone who had it.
Yeah,
or they survived it, or they're about to have it. So you can never win. But a black audience, you say cancer, they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
White people are very sensitive about cancer. So when you talk about divorce, a topic like that, remember that when you tell the joke over and over, you become extra passionate about the joke.
Sure.
Then you add yourself, and then you add little nuances, then you put facts.
Yeah.
That's a Molotov cocktail, which is different from the beginning when you started telling the joke, which was just your humble opinion and wild observation of stuff. The better it becomes, the more truthful it becomes. Now you're the guy going, you know, this virus is going to kill us all. And I feel like, which part of that is funny?
So, and that's the thing too, is it's like, I know, I like my parents got divorced, right? But they still didn't get divorced. Oof, six times. Oh. And one on the way, like that, like his divorces are like saying that you already have six kids and you're pregnant, because you know the seventh one isn't gonna work out. You know it. So it's like someone should warn her. Like, that's crazy.
I always think, you know, what you just mentioned now is, it's something that you can't explain to someone who doesn't do comedy. When they go, what does it feel like? You go, sometimes you have those days where you just take the rifle and you stick it in your mouth and you want to see what happens.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get so happy knowing that you're at a knife's edge of death on stage. It's a weird thing.
But it does happen. Absolutely.
And you start telling stories that you know might get you into trouble, but you go, hey, we're here anyway. None of this is going to affect my 80% chance of getting to work early on the train. So here we go. Here's a story. And I think once you get there as a comic, once you take more of those risks, and by those risks, I don't mean absurd stuff. Mm. I mean stuff that makes you laugh. Because the stuff that makes the audience laugh, and the stuff that makes you laugh. And then we always secretly hope that the stuff that makes us laugh, the audience will be like, finally, here you are.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, have you... Like, even just as an example, because this is a thing that I haven't even, like, I haven't had the chance because I was thinking about it today to like talk about it on stage or anything. But like, there's this thing. Do you listen to Michael Bublé in South Africa? Okay. So this is a thing that has been on my mind a lot, that everyone is talking about being an ally and like sticking up for people that you know have been tramped on by society or just need a little bit extra help and everything. And we never give credit to the people that do that just by nature of who they are. Like they're not an activist. They're not, you know what I mean? Like they're not on social media talking about all the time, but just by who they are, they're doing a lot. And I think that Michael Bublé is one of those people. I think Michael Bublé has saved more Black lives than you could ever imagine. Because when you are getting pulled over, you need to turn down that Tekashi 6ix9ine. You need to turn down, maybe even Drake is too dangerous at some points. And you need to put on some Michael Bublé for when they walk up to the car, all right? I can't tell you how many times Michael Bublé just blaring has got me out of a jail, okay? He's doing great work, and he's not getting enough credit for it.
You should get an NAACP award.
Yeah.
Most Black lives saved in cars. Kenny G.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny Rogers.
Josh Groban.
Josh Groban.
As soon as I roll down the window and the police hear, it's a new dawn, it's a new day, and I'm never driving. I don't drive. So it'll just be it's always the Black person I'm with. I'm like, hey, turn that down. Look, get on my Spotify playlist. Hit up this Michael Bublé because you were definitely speeding. Like you did that shit.
When you mentioned those artists, I thought of Seal, and I'm like, Seal has not been one of us for the longest of time.
Nah.
Like, you take Kiss from a rose, you're safe, my man. No cop is taking you down. that's so funny. When you're talking about transport, how do you balance it in your head, right? Because I can speak from my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So where did I come from? I think I came from here. So you fly commercial, you land, you take an Uber, you end up somewhere, and then the next time you're in another country, in another town, on a private jet. How, am I the only one who still finds that trippy?
No, not at all.
I find people act casual when they walk in a jet like it's normal. People walk in like it's normal and they squeeze through and then they find a comfortable chair to sit. And I'm like, none of this is normal. So
yeah,
how do you make the adjustment? Earlier in the day, you were stuck in the subway with an 80% chance of making it on time.
Yeah.
And then 8 hours later, you're in Teterboro in a private jet going somewhere to have fun with thousands of people.
I always keep the perspective by knowing it's not my jet. I am very much a guest on this jet. I think if I had a jet, you wouldn't be able to tell me anything. But knowing this jet could leave without me is, I don't have any misgivings about my station in life. You know? And then I will say, this is the funny thing about flying private and all that other stuff is, it's all of it is just proof that people are the worst. Because really? anything that gives you the ability to do something with less people is super expensive. Anything. Think of anything, and now think of just doing it by yourself or with a couple of friends. That's very expensive. You know, it's like if you want to live in a big apartment complex, it's not going to cost you that much. If you want to have that same amount of space but with six people, that's called a mansion, and it's going to be very, very expensive. It's like if you even want to just fly, you know, if you want to fly from New York to Chicago, it's not going to cost you that much. But if you want to fly from New York to Chicago and you really want to put your feet up and relax and not worry about crying babies or anything like that, it's going to cost you, you know? So it's just all private things are just proof that like people, Not being around people is one of the biggest luxuries in life. You know what I mean? Think about even real estate. Like the most expensive thing is a private island. Yes. A private island isn't even good. It's not. There's no supermarket there. All the amenities of life don't exist there. It's just no people.
Uber Eats can't get to you.
No. Yeah. It's gonna be harder to get even on a private jet, and it's just a patch of dirt in the water. But you know what? There's no people there. Nobody to bother me. I can finally read my book in peace. That's the thing. Mm.
My first time in a private jet, I always found it funny that people fell asleep. And I was like, why? In commercial, we sleep to escape. What is your problem here?
Yeah, but in private, you get that good sleep. Like private, you're relaxed. Like you're leaning back further than you can. There's even like, I don't know, don't some jets have a bed?
Yeah. They always have like a little couchy going on.
Yeah. So like, that's amazing sleep.
Have you ever gotten off from one of your tours and you get off the jet, you get in the car, you get to your apartment, and then you walk through the door of your apartment building and then you go, do you guys know where I was? Do you look at people and you go, do you know who you've done a show with 10,000 people, you were in a jet, you were screaming, loving Josh, and then you come back to your apartment, everything is as normal as fuck. People have just come back from work. Some people are going through their sixth divorce. You know, you just walk in there, like, you're like, do you guys know?
I think, once again, I think that if it was for me, I would definitely be wilding out on people. Do you know where I just was? But the fact that like it's as amazing as it is and as grateful as I am, it's also like I'm more there to learn and to get better and to hopefully have a day where I have lots of people coming to see me specifically and have really fallen in love with my comedy and stuff. And until then, it's just like it's amazing and it's like been life changing, but it also isn't like there isn't a permanence that I feel to it because I still have my own way to go, you know, like I still have a long ways to go, all by myself.
100%. I find that I used to be like you a while back. I used to let things happen. And then I would look at how much of it is repeatable through me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I take on experiences now, I always equate it to, imagine if you come from a rich family, right?
Yeah.
Super wealthy. And then everything that happens, when someone walks into that house to come and put up a new painting, they don't care who's in there. They don't care.
Yeah.
All they care about is when they look at you inside the house, they go, damn it. I don't know how you got in here. But whatever it is that you did, that's good for you.
Yeah, and I think
that's the part where a lot of people miss out on. And when I think of like my early days and when I wasn't that present in my circumstance, I used to worry a lot about that. It's almost like worrying about the process instead of enjoying the moment.
So
for example, if you're at Madison Square Gardens and all of those people are sitting there, whether they came there for you or not, the fact that at Madison Square Garden, if the universe orchestrated that moment to happen for you instead of happening through you, then that's all that matters, you know. And sometimes you get that live outside of the experience. And you see it with comedy most of the time when people are like, it has to be my time to shine now. Even my material has to change a little bit. I'm like, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
And I see it a lot with US comics. And I'm like, if you guys knew how lucky you are to be able to perform to the audiences that you have, the variety of people that you get to perform to, and the frequency in one night, the grumpiness backstage or at the table would definitely end.
Sure, yeah. keep going, sorry.
Yeah, so I'm like, you can do 4 or 5 shows a night. In South Africa, you'd be lucky if you can do 5 clubs in a week. And I'm talking about good clubs, right? So when I see comics going, oh man, you know, that bit tripped me up and I wish I could. I'm like, you don't have to wish. You can just go do it again. You don't have to wish.
Yeah.
And the open-mindedness of American audiences is by far unmatched. The last time I had an audience that open-minded was when I was doing the Sydney Comedy Festival. And I was like, you have to understand that audiences are not the same all over the world, right?
Yes,
they're very forgiving. They're embracing to comedy and they let you finish your joke, which I'm like, if you suck in the US, you suck in life. Just
yeah, yeah. Yeah, it can get pretty unfairly easy here. Like, especially if you go to a place that just doesn't have that much live comedy. Oh, and you go there and you at least know what you're doing. Oh, you'll feel like a god. You'll feel, yeah. And it'll pump you up too much. Like I like New York because New York still has aspects of people being like, what is this guy talking about? I don't know if I... Is this guy like slow or something? I don't really. It's too much and it's too combative. And then you have to overcome that. And then when you take that, whatever jokes you wrote that captivated that audience, then those things start to work in lots of places. Like I've been very fortunate to travel to Australia and Mexico, Canada, stuff like that. And the jokes still work. And I think they still work. Not just because I'm trying to write for everyone, but because I had New Yorkers in my face, like, I don't,
what's this
I don't
guy
know about that one. Yeah. What is he? Is he lost?
Do you feel like the more big shows you do, the more your audience grows? Do you feel like
a little bit? I've seen it a little bit. Yeah. It's because now I think people come. Okay, so before, maybe even like, I would say even like 2 years ago, if people came to my show, only a couple of them had ever seen anything I had ever done before, whether it was on YouTube or anything else. And now I would even say there's been a weird shift where most of the people who come have seen me do something before. So I'm hoping that's a good thing. I'm hoping that means that I'm, you know, getting the people who have seen me, they now want to come see me live or see me again. And hopefully it's not a bad sign that there are less people who come that have no idea who I am or what I've done. But I just like that is a weird thing I've noticed, where it's like those first few years, it was like, oh, I just was bored, thought I'd go to a comedy show and happened to be here this weekend and I liked it and you know, whatever. But now it's like, oh, I saw you on YouTube or I listened to your album or something like that. And that's been that. I think that's that more than anything we've discussed. That's the thing that trips me out the most.
Yeah.
Because so much of the first years of comedy are doing comedy that's barely good into a vacuum. So the fact that now I've done things and forgotten about them, like I don't think about my, like if you see me do something, if some of my stuff on YouTube is like more than 2 or 3 years old, I probably don't tell those jokes anymore. So it's like when someone comes up to me after a show and they're like, I loved your thing about this. And I'm just kind of like, oh yeah, I did do that joke for like a year. You know what I mean? And that's crazy that someone received that and they really like it and they like that enough to come see me do an hour. You know what I mean? Of new stuff. Of stuff that could go very wrong. I might have snapped. They don't know me. They don't know. I could be out of my mind now.
So wait, the transition from, you're not originally from New York, right?
No. So I grew up in Louisiana and I started doing comedy in Chicago.
Wait, explain to us how that happened. How do you
go from? So basically I was born in Louisiana, but I knew I wanted to do comedy from like a fairly young age and there just weren't the opportunities around. Like they just didn't exist. Like where I grew up, there was no comedy club. And then where I went to college, there was one comedy club that closed. So then it was like, if I want to do anything, I'm going to have to move somewhere. And, you know, my college professor got it in my head to go to Chicago because it was a great, secondary market in the US. It's one of the best markets because you can get really, really big in Chicago, and that's a taste of what being big will feel like, but you're still unknown in the rest of the country and the rest of the world. So it's a nice little, it's a nice little mini step in between, like, okay, people, this is what it'll be like when people like my stuff, but now I need to go out into the world and really expand, you know? And so I moved to Chicago right after college and then started doing comedy there. And that's where I spent, like, what I'd even say were some of my, like, formative years, like trying to get good, trying to learn the craft and everything. And then I moved to New York, and I've been in New York for, like, this is like my fifth year or something.
What inspired the move? How did you go from Chicago to, I'm going to New York now? Did you get a job?
Not yet. I didn't actually have a job yet. Yeah, it was literally just a ceiling. You hit a ceiling in Chicago because, like I was saying, it's a taste of what of what a lot of people. Yeah. And so once you have that, I would say, and I'm not telling anybody else what to do, but this is what it felt like for me. I would say if you have that feeling for like a year, it's time to move on. Yeah. You know? Because like I could have stayed in Chicago. Exactly, yeah. So, you know, had to make the move.
So you get to New York, your first week, your first month. Did you have friends over there that were already working in the clubs, obviously?
So I had two friends that I moved with that were my roommates and almost nobody else. It was terrible. When I moved here, oh man, it was bad. So the first place I lived when I was here was I lived in a hallway because No. So this is what happened. So this is terrible. So I worked at a grocery store in Chicago, and I used that grocery store job to transfer to New York. So that way I at least moved with a job, right? Because so many people move to a new city and they have to literally restart from scratch, you know, get a job, get all this stuff. I wanted to be able to hit the ground running, so I made sure I transferred my job. The way that that happened was my lease on my new apartment with my friends was in November, but my job said, if you want to move, you have to move in October. So I just wasn't going to, I needed to figure out where I was going to stay because I wouldn't have a place for like a month. And so then I was looking, like asking other comics, hey, do you know anybody, anything, anybody have a room? And I'm also like not moving with that much money. So I also have to temper, you know, like it's not like I can stay in a hotel for a month or something, you know? So then I finally get a hold of this guy and he's like, hey, you can have this room for this much and you can move in as soon as you get off the plane, whatever. So that's what I do. I send him the money and then I come on the airport. I leave the airport, go straight. I couldn't even get a taxi. This is what I'm talking about when it comes to money. I couldn't even like get on the plane, get off the plane at the airport, get a taxi. I had to take the bus, right? And so then I'm on the bus with just my few things. I didn't have that many things at all. And so I'm just on the bus with my stuff. I take two buses and then get to the apartment. And when I walk in, the room that he has told me about is only technically a room. It is it is basically the hallway to the next room, which is a real room, right? So there's a guy who lives in that room. And then there's the kitchen. And then there's my room. So then if that guy wants to get to his room, he has to leave the kitchen, pass through my room, and then go to. And they were saying it was like a railroad. Have you heard of that? Like a railroad apartment, whatever. So sometimes, especially in New Orleans, this is popular, there'll be railroad houses where like every room is like that. So instead of the rooms being spaced out and apart, they're just in succession, just one long building. That works in New Orleans if it's your house. You know what I mean? This was not the case. Like, I'm in a hallway. And then, And so then I would be sleeping, and this dude would straight up just have to step over me. Because I didn't have a bed. Because there was no this is how much of not a room it was. There was no bed in there when I got there. And it's not like he promised me a bed. I'm just saying, like, the fact that we couldn't fit a bed in here means this is a hallway.
And by virtue of him saying room, you expected a bed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was like, look, this was also hella cheap. So I can't fully, it's not like I can demand my money back because I also don't have anywhere else to stay. So it's not like I'm like, beggars can't be choosers, you know? And so then I end up just sleeping on the couch in the living room for a month because I'm like, guys, that's not a room. And the couch is right here. So I'm just going to sleep on the couch and chill. And so I use that hallway for storing my stuff, or like when I was on my computer or something. But eventually I just had to start sleeping on the couch because I tried sleeping in there the first night. And I was like, this is insane. This is the guy that lived in the room, as he tried to get to his room, he was trying not to disturb me. And I still smelled his foot like stepping over my head. And I was like, this is bad. I can't live like this. Even if it's just for 30 days, this is, ooh, prisoners get a bed.
And they killed somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, all you did was get a transfer and then you are in the railroad apartment. So wait, so you stay over there for a month, finally your apartment is ready. How long before you start your job at the supermarket?
Oh no, the next day. Like the day after I got off the flight. So you woke up from sleeping
on the floor and smelling a foot straight to a new job, meeting new people?
Yeah, yeah. And trying to convince them, nah, I'm normal, you know? These are just my circumstances that make me look odd at the moment. I swear I'm a regular guy. Oh, it was terrible. And then this is the other thing that kind of sucked. There was like a delay with my roommates where one of them took he was doing a bunch of road gigs or something. So he didn't move in until the middle of the month. And then my other roommate was having some sort of issue with the moving company. So my bed and my like stuff, I gave to her and then gave her money to put with her stuff for the moving truck. Right. So that's why when I moved to New York, I didn't have like, I had like my clothes and my computer and that was it. And so there was some sort of hiccup where she couldn't make it for a little while, even after November 1st. So then I just had to, move in by myself, and there's nothing in there. It's just an apartment. And so I had to move in by myself. And then I actually had to sleep on the floor for 2 weeks. Because there was no couch. There was no. So I had to use my backpack as a pillow.
That experience you just described sounds like being in the township. Have you ever seen images of the township?
No. I think I've seen maybe a couple, but not like, I don't know it well, you know?
Yeah, there's like small rooms. Small. There used to be these houses called four-roomed houses, which means a living room, a kitchen, and two bedrooms, right? Notice I didn't say bathroom anyway.
Yeah.
The bathroom is outside. So whenever you're bathing in there, you have to block with your one hand because, you know, at my house, then we're never allowed to lock doors. It's not your damn house. So why are you locking doors? If there's so many of us, what if I need the room? So whenever you're bathing, you need to block the door with your one hand and then wash with the other hand. So you basically, you're in a township for a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Month and a half, technically. Oh, dude, so how far
from then to your writing job? When do you quit the supermarket?
Oh, I didn't even quit the supermarket after I had the writing job.
What?
Yeah, you just gotta. Hey, you gotta be careful. You can't just jump out. This is a steady job. I know it doesn't pay as much as the writing job, but you gotta have your bases covered. So basically, yeah, I was working at the grocery store for a few months, and then got the opportunity to, they do a thing in the States. I don't know if there's something similar in South Africa, but they do a thing in the States called NACA. And it's where all of the colleges, basically all the colleges that want to bring comedians, magicians, singers, like all the different entertainment acts, they will have these conferences where you audition to be in the conference. Then if you get into the conference, you do a performance, and it's like an audition in front of all the schools to see if they want to bring you or not. So I got to do two NACA conferences. And from those two conferences, I booked like a ton of shows. I booked a lot. Like it was amazing, right? So then I ended up going on like a bit of a college tour for maybe it's almost 6 months. And then when I got back, I was doing a set that I wanted to get put on The Tonight Show. And when I sent it to The Tonight Show, they asked me if I wanted to submit a writing packet because they liked my jokes, not just the set. And so I did, and I wrote a writing packet, sent it in, and then they asked me for another one, and then I wrote another one and sent it in, and then I had an interview, and then I got the job, right? So it all was happening in everything was so weird and new that I didn't even have time to freak out about it.
I think that's the problem. We're developing a pattern here of you not being able to process great things as they happen.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure it is. It's like, but
you,
I think...
You were in a passage smelling someone's foot. Woke up, went to the grocery store. A month later, your roommate came without your bed 2 weeks using your backpack as a... And then you were on a NACA. Then NACA conference leads you to 6 months on the road doing a tour. You come back, you submit a tape. They ask for two writing packages, and you're writing on The Tonight Show. Come on,
yeah.
John.
Yeah, but you gotta understand. It's like I didn't like see it coming, so I wasn't like anticipating. I think that in retrospect, that was a good thing because now I have all these great memories, but I didn't psych myself out, you know? I didn't like stress myself out like, oh, that's right, I really need this job. Oh, I don't want to work at the grocery store. It's like, look, I love the grocery store. I loved working there. I love the people there. I love the customers. So I was like, I was at a great baseline. Like I was chilling, you know? So it's like, whether I get this job or not, I'll be all right. Because then I'm also doing stand-up at night. And now I'm doing stand-up at night and my jokes are working in New York, which feels insane. So like that was... I think that in retrospect, it seems weird that I was just like, oh yeah, I guess I'll go work at The Tonight Show and I'll work at the grocery store on Sundays. That's what I'll do.
You are literally behaving like how Morty behaves when he's hanging out with Rick. You like, I don't know how cool Rick is as a granddad to take you on interstellar, intergalactic adventures. And you're like, oh geez, Rick. Then you're like, Rick, I'm going home again. But you're like, you've just been in outer space and shot an alien in the face.
Yeah, but you gotta have your priorities in order, you know? I got rent to pay. I gotta make sure that whether it's the writing job or the grocery store job, I have one job.
So how do you go from, how long is The Tonight Show? How long do you stick around at the grocery store? And then how do you get to The Daily Show?
So eventually, I think when I got my first check from The Tonight Show, I was like, oh, I don't need to work at the grocery store anymore. Okay.
My first clue to that would not have been the check. It would have been the fact that I'm at The Tonight Show. That would have been enough for me. Because if I bumped into one of the guys at The Tonight Show within that first month at the grocery store, packing groceries with me on Sunday, then that would have been my clue to stay at the job. If I didn't see them anywhere... how many more clues did you need? How many
I don't
more
know. Clues did you need? I just had to make sure they were going to keep me around and everything. You know, you just want to have a little back thing in your pocket, you know, a little fail safe.
In whatever job, this is a tip for next time. In whatever job you go, you must always just look around. If you're the only black guy there, or one of a few, you're safe. Because they need you more than you need them.
Yeah, yeah.
And if the people that you work with, if you suss out which neighborhood and what where they hang out on the weekends, it means you can sort of draw a baseline of how much money you're also going to make and where you're going to live and hang out.
Yeah, yeah.
So why weren't you applying all of that? Because you had two worlds you were living in. You were living in a world on Sunday at the grocery store, and you knew definitely where the homies at the grocery store were living and how much money they're earning. And then in this other world, you were working with writers that live in Brooklyn, Manhattan, all of these places, and talk about going to nightclubs and whatever. And then you never drew the parallel that your life was changing?
Yeah, I just wasn't sure if it was changing for good, you know? Look, you've probably heard the story of Icarus. It's like, look, at a certain point, you don't know, you never know when you're going to peak. So you always want to have plan B's and C's and D's ready.
Where does that come from? It has to come from somewhere.
I mean, I think it just comes from not having money. I think that when you, when you don't have money for long enough, you almost don't trust having money. You know what I mean? And so then I think there's a little bit of an aspect. I'm not saying it's healthy. I don't think it's good at all. I wish I could change it. But I think that there is something to be said for, like, if you go without for long enough, you're going to be like, this is the baseline. And I think it's one of the reasons why, when you look around the world, why wealth seems to be attracted to the same-minded individuals over and over again, no matter how much they mess up. They get in $100 million of debt, and then they get themselves out of that debt, and then they make $100 million, is because whatever you believe your baseline to be, you will work yourself there. You know, it's why people who win the lottery somehow end up broke again. It's like, that was free money and you're broke, you know? So I've had to change my mindset towards, like, what my baseline is and what feels normal to me is. And I finally extracted that part that expects myself to be poor, if that makes sense, which took a long time. It took years. Cause if you look at, like, if you look at my tax returns for the majority of my life, there were years where the government was like, hey, you good. Don't worry about it. I got this one. You need it more than me. You know? And so now that Uncle Sam is coming, I'm like, maybe this is the new normal.
Do you feel good spending? Do you sometimes now walk into a place and just buy something and be like, I bought it. There was no particular reason except for the fact that I like it.
Oh, so there's two things, right? Yeah. One, I will go years, like legit as many years as possible without spending any money on anything I don't think is necessary. But then when the feeling that I enjoy the most is walking into a place and knowing I could buy anything and just knowing I don't really want to. So it's like, I'll just keep my money. But knowing that, like, oh, look at this. I don't even know if I can describe this to you appropriately, but I walked into a store. This wasn't even that long ago. I walked into a store and there was a jacket that was so weird looking. I couldn't tell if it was dope or the dumbest thing I had ever seen in my life. Because it looked like a jacket had exploded out of another jacket. Like, it looked like a jacket was hanging out of a jacket. Right. And so it was different patterns. So, like, the inner pattern was different here on, like, the breastplate than the rest of it, but it didn't look like it was supposed to be that. Like, the whole jacket looked like a mistake, and it was $500. And I was like, this is, I could get this, but I don't want it. And I don't want it, not just because it's really dumb, but because it's like, I don't need it. Like, I'm not going to get anything else out of having it, you know? The thing that I binge on now, especially this year, this is the first year where I've gotten really comfortable with, like, I'll spend money if I want to spend money because I don't spend that much. And it's not like I'm not into cars or anything. I'm not actually into anything super expensive anyway. So the need to be frugal is slightly lessened by that. But now I've realized I will drop money on, like, food. If there's a specific thing that I want to eat, I'll, like, it doesn't matter. I'll go ahead and I'll get that food. The other thing has been comic books. I've, like, it's starting to become a problem. Like, I'm
really, you hunt them down, like,
Yeah.
Search for places and look for it and find
like
it.
Like a fiend. They look at me like when I show up at that comic book store, they look at me like I'm on drugs. They're like, oh, there he is again. Oh, no.
Do you spend a lot of money on comic books?
What I consider a lot, yeah, relatively, yeah. But I don't like, because I love stories, I love a good story, man. A good story to me is like, because the thing with a story, unlike with a meal or with a car or anything like that, it doesn't, unless your memory is going, it doesn't wear down. Like you can just, like an incredible movie, like a really good movie has like staying power and you can just enjoy it again and again and again. And for me, comic books are like that. Like, I love reading comic books because they give me the same experience as a movie, but at my own pace. Like I'm hitting pause whenever I want to go do something, whatever, and I don't have to worry about missing anything. I think that there are stories that are easier to get made in comic books than there are to make movies of. So as a result, comic books have a wider breadth of types of stories, because if we wanted to make a movie out of this or a TV show, we'd need millions of dollars because it's a sci-fi story about aliens or whatever. But if we're just drawing it, yeah. And I mean, comic books still are expensive to make. Like if you wanted to make a big comic book with the best artists and the best writers, it would still set you back a lot of money, but it's nothing compared to like a full-on movie production, you know?
So do you buy them to keep them, or I take it you read some of them?
So
like this is a volume one minted.
No, I'm not into collectibles because I'm actually just here to like read the story. Like the people who are into collectibles, I actually don't get, because I'm like, guys, the pages are aging. Like even if you keep it in the plastic, time is fucking that thing up. Like, time is coming for your investment, man. You can't just, when I read it, I can't imagine, this is going to sound super nerdy. You might even want to cut this out. This might not make me look good, but the thing that made me feel like I was bawling out, I just came back from a gig where I was doing some shows and stuff. And when I was in this other town, I was like, let me go to a comic book shop here because maybe they have stuff here that they maybe don't even have in New York. Because the problem sometimes with New York is that everything is so new and shiny and everything that they lose sight of some of the back issues of cool stuff. So I go to this comic book store, and one of my favorite writers working with one of my favorite artists has a book out that the guy at the comic book store is like, yeah, I just can't seem to sell it. Like, it's just, and I was like, well, let me take it off your hands. and honestly, ripping the plastic off of that thing, because it is new, like it's a new book that they wrote, but ripping the plastic off that thing is like, ooh, this must be what drugs feel like.
Yeah.
Because it's dope.
Yeah. That feeling of you being the first one opening it and the story that's contained in it.
Yeah.
My attraction to books is kind of different because I read a lot of esoterical books.
Mm-hmm.
And I love secondhand books more than I love brand new books. I love.
Yeah.
Because with secondhand books, you get that little message. It's almost like a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
Someone bought the book for someone when they were going through something.
Yeah.
And they put the message and they put the date. And then you feel like this is 20 years later, you open the same page that someone opened when they're going through something. And it kind of makes me always realize that no problem is brand new.
Yeah, yeah.
And no circumstance lasts forever. Because I can't think that if someone is like, sorry about the loss of your father, and I hope this book gets you through. I doubt that 20 years later, they still feel the exact same pain. So that on its own is a sign that nothing lasts forever. But when you open the same pages that gave them healing, that for me is my addiction to use books. I think I must have like over 100 of them.
Yeah.
I just love it. And you find these little places whenever you travel around
sell
books, and you look at them and you go, how did someone miss this book? I've sometimes bought the same book four times.
Yeah.
Because the opening page stories are so different.
I'm telling you. Also, the other thing, so I used to be like that, especially when I was high school, college, and early when I lived in Chicago, there was a place that I would go to. It was my favorite bookstore in Chicago because I could walk there and it was only half a mile away from my place. And like every week or two, I'd buy a new book from there and just like tear through it. But they were all secondhand. It was exactly what you're describing. But every once in a while, I'd read a book and then someone would have, because I've read a lot of like Eastern philosophy stuff. And every once in a while, I'd buy a book and someone had like, you know, you just mark in the pages and the margins what you're thinking and stuff. And I was reading this one book and I was like, oh, whoever this is going through it. I was like, yo, this is too much information. This is deeper than the book.
That's a funny bit. You should do that. That's now you're reading his pencil sketch.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just reading his like etchings in the bar, just like, well, what happened with the girl? Just you can't leave me hanging. It was bad. And the even the comic book thing is fairly recent. Like that, like I went on, I don't know if you do this with your hobbies, but I feel like I go through intervals of my hobbies. So I'll care very much about them for maybe a year or two or 4 years. And then because most of my hobbies aren't passions, you know, it's just things I like to do in my spare time. So then I'll take like maybe even 4 or 5 years off of comic books. And then when I come back, there's just this wealth of stuff that I miss that I get to catch up on. You know, it's almost like waiting to watch a series until the finale is over and you can just watch it all at once. Because yeah. I, right around the time I started buying comic books again this year, I also, this is how you know I lost my mind in quarantine. I went ahead, I bought some nunchucks. Oh man. And I am not good. Oh, it's bad. I have hurt myself twice. it's bad.
Ah, fuck, that's funny.
Yeah.
Where do you even find nunchucks? Which?
Oh, Chinatown. Yeah, you just roll through Chinatown. This was crazy, though. So, all in all, I have bought 3 pairs of nunchucks, right?
Oh,
I
bought
No. This is important, right? So I bought the foam. There's a foam practice pair that you're supposed to use for when you're learning and getting good. That one still hurts. I perfectly hit myself in my left nut and it dropped me to the ground. Cause it's still like, it's still, even though it's foam, the foam is around. Yeah. And the foam has weight around something hard. Like the foam does not protect you. So then, I'm practicing with my foam ones and they are so cheaply made that the foam ones break on the first day. Right. So like I've had them for literally 24 hours. So the next day they break. Yeah. Then I'm like, okay, well now all I have left are the wooden ones, which I was going to wait to work with until I was good. So now I could only use the ones that are really going to hurt me. And so my girlfriend was going out with her friends and she was actually going to pass Chinatown. I was like, hey, can you get me another pair that like might be somewhere in between the cheap foam pair and this one, which is like actually dangerous. Yeah. And so she comes home, she brings me this beautiful, beautiful pair of round, like, does the podcast have a video portion?
Josh will make it happen. Yeah.
Okay, well, look, so this is... Because the people listening won't be able to see it. So these are the wooden ones.
Oh,
and these are rough. These will mess you up, right? Like, I could kill myself. And then... the ones that she got me are also wooden, but they're smooth and they have ridges for your hands and they are beautifully made. Like this is a work of art and it's balanced. The other one is not balanced well. I've made a couple mistakes. Yeah. And I wasn't sure if it was my fault. Right. But these are like beautifully balanced and I don't think I've hurt myself with these and I'm starting to get a little bit good, but oh, it was, It's terrible. It was. That's how I knew I lost it.
When is the best time to practice nunchucks? Is it?
I mean,
morning, afternoon, night. When can you take the pain and still continue with the day?
Really, the middle of the day. If I'm done with my work for the day and I hurt myself, now I can just ice up for the rest of the day. Because if I hurt myself before bed, I'm gonna wake up hurt, you know. But and sometimes, what are you gonna say?
I'm saying, when will you ever need nunchucks in your life? I'm just
never. Like, no, never. This is probably one of the most ineffective weapons in the world, because basically it's a broken stick. Because anyone you hit with a nunchuck, you could have hit better with a stick.
I think if the guy tried very hard to sell you that jacket that you didn't need, if they compared the situation with the nunchucks, they would have sold you the jacket. Because both of them are on par. For me, that jacket and these nunchucks, same WhatsApp group.
Dude, but look, if I can get really, really, really good, I'll have a new skill.
To use it where, Josh?
I mean, probably never, but but I'll have the option, right? Like let's say I mean, God forbid, but let's say I'm in a situation where I'm in, like, I'm getting robbed, right? Like, I'm a full-on stick-up. He's got a gun. He wants my wallet. In my head, I'll be thinking, damn, if I had my nunchucks, I could probably fuck him up before he shot me. If only they were here, I could at least bust his lip before he fired three into my chest.
The one thing that irritates me about nunchucks, and I think that's why maybe as a weapon in history, Bruce Lee was the only person that could pull it off. It just seems like a lot of paperwork before they start working for you. You have to work for them before they can actually work for, because you can't just whip them and go pow. You just have to, right? Hit your ribs, bruise your back of your head, and then hopefully hit someone somewhere. And whenever I see nunchucks, I'm like, nunchucks hit the owner in more effective places than they ever could the victim.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So it hits you in the back, it hits you in the ribs, it hits you in the spine. And then where are you hoping to land the nunchucks on your victim?
So,
over to you, George.
So I will tell you that in my life, I have seen nunchucks effectively used one time. So I was walking down the street, and I don't know if these dudes were playing around or if they were actual enemies and this was like an epic showdown, but basically one guy had nunchucks and the other guy just had his fists, right? And the guy went to do one of the sweeping moves, you know, like when you're doing the back thing. And right when he did it, he popped that dude on the chin and knocked him out. And I was like, wow, there is one person alive that's actually really good with nunchucks. And to be fair, though, I don't know if he, like, that could have been his friend and he didn't mean to knock him out, in which case no human has still used nunchucks effectively. But if that was an enemy, if that person was really coming at him, oof, he got him. I mean, he may even knocked out a tooth. Like when you think about it, because he caught him under the chin and made his head pop back and knocked him out. So, I mean, he did something. He did some damage.
Oh man, Josh, you made me laugh, man. But you can. Do you have a story that even if you told us, we wouldn't believe it? Like, even if you were like, I wouldn't be making this up, even if I tried. But the nunchuck story killed me.
Oh, okay. So one time, I talked about this on stage before, but I've talked about it on stage when I first moved to Chicago, because it just happened in college. Like, not just, but it had happened in college, and now I'm like, I wish I had kept telling it, because then I'd have a crisper retelling of it. But but basically, I got taken to my first college party. Was a disaster. I met these people. We weren't all really friends yet. And in fact, to this day, I'm only friends with one of them. I don't know where the other ones are. And they were like,
from being hit by nunchucks in the chin.
At least one of them. There was only one guy getting hit. But basically, they took me to this party, and none of us had been there before except one of them. So this one woman that was with us had been there before. So we're all just following her car, and I'm not driving. I'm like in the back seat with my other buddy. And so everyone is just trailing her, and then we get to the house, and the house looks like, have you ever seen Fight Club? It looks like that house. It looks exactly like the Fight Club house, right? It's just disheveled, but it's big. It's like, it's not a mansion, but it's huge, but it is bad, right? So then I walk in with them, and there are no doors anywhere. Like there's a door to the house, but once you go in, everywhere there should be a door, there's just a sheet. There's just like a sheet hanging up. And so I'm walking in, there are already people there, and somehow, I don't know if I take a wrong turn, but I immediately lose my friends. Like, they're gone, right? And so now I'm just here by myself, and this place looks like sketchy, like really, really bad. Like, even the people inside, I'm like, oh, you don't do anything legal. This is, these are some nefarious individuals, right? And so then I open one of the curtains, because now I'm just looking for my friends again, and I open one of the curtains, and there's just two people passed out on a mattress on the floor, and I'm like, oh yeah, we got to get out of here. This is terrible. This is definitely, drugs are definitely happening here. And so then I'm still looking for my friends. I can't find them. I go upstairs, I come back downstairs, and then I'm like, did they leave me? I'm just freaking out, right? Because I only have one of their numbers. Because like I said, I'm only really friends with one guy that was brought here. And so then I just sit on the couch. And in the house, in the living room, they had a bunch of couches. Like, it was actually too many couches. And so I'm just sitting on one of the couches, just like,
people have been getting lost in that house.
Yeah. Like, just, I'm just stressed out because I'm just sitting there like, I lost my friends, everything. And then a guy sits across from me. He sits across from me on the other couch. And doesn't say anything to me, but he just takes out a pipe and starts smoking crack in front of me, and I legit just start crying. Because I'm not built for this, man. I'm like, and he takes one of the longest drags of anything I've ever seen someone take. He's just like, like wide eyes, everything. His lungs must have been his whole body. And so I'm just sitting on the couch crying while this dude makes eye contact with me, dragging his pipe.
Did you eventually find your friend?
Yeah, eventually. And one of them, like, then then one of them was like too messed up to drive, because then she took a hit of the dude's weed at the house, and I don't know, he must have got his weed from Mars, because I've never seen someone react to weed the way that she reacted to this.
That's why there's no doors in that house.
Yeah, you gotta keep track of people. Oh, there was actually, I don't know if this is really unbelievable. I'm trying to think of one that I have. I feel like so many of my stories are like mundane, that like that to an unbelievable thing that wouldn't be if you told me. Oh, okay. Because the other one that I have is like also fairly believable. Like, it's just people are on drugs, you know.
I feel like the nunchuck story, Josh, the other Josh. That should be our unbelievable story. That nunchuck story killed me.